This week on A to Z Running, Allie, Craig, and Laura help us dig deeper into the challenges of effort-based training and racing, whether new runners only just getting started or longtime runners many years into it.
Also, we field some questions about terrain times and proper long run duration.
In the world of running, the last high school cross-country race, Foot Locker Nationals, was exciting.
What happens when pro runners race in paradise?
And we'll give you two guesses which NCAA runner just turned pro, and you better get it right.
All this and more on A to Z Running. Welcome back to ADZ Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I'm Zach. And just a reminder that you can learn more about our services and support for runners at AToZRunning.com. And be sure to follow us on the places like Instagram, Spotify, and YouTube, among others.
Mm-hmm. I always like to mention when I get to see runners and get to interact with people that I enjoy seeing. So I was able to literally run into some friends.
Did it hurt?
This week. It did not hurt because we didn't collide.
But you did say literally.
Because we ran into one another. Well,
so
I guess
that's
into.
Figurative.
I literally ran by.
Oh, okay. Yeah, good.
And with. So for one of the times I ran with Steph. So I didn't realize, but I had kind of crashed her and her husband's run date.
Oh, don't do that. Those are already hard enough to come by.
I know. But then she was going a little further, so I continued to run with her.
So you stole her from her
from Mike. Yeah.
Husband.
I'm sorry, Mike. But it was a lot of fun to be able to run with Steph spontaneously midweek. And then on Saturday, I ran into or bye.
That's better. Yep.
Steph again, Sarah, another one of our athletes, and their friend Rachel. So that was fun. And I was running with a couple friends too. So it fills me with joy to see my friends, and I absolutely love it.
That is wonderful. So in other kinds of interactions with runners, it continues to be true that I'm getting a lot of questions about Strava right now, specifically why I am not posting on Strava.
Did you already talk about this?
I have. I feel I need to remind because I continue to get so many questions. It is deliberate, and no, there's nothing wrong with me. Well, there's a lot of things wrong with me, but none of them specifically are stopping me from running at the moment. So what it is deliberate. I'm not posting on Strava because I'm not using any kind of technologies to track my running right now. It's an experiment. And I have two things to say about it at this juncture, which is why I'm saying this again. New information. So it's not just that I'm telling you the same thing you already knew. I'm not posting on Strava. That's it. But two observations at this moment in time with this experiment. One, it is definitely true that not having any kind of measurement or clear measurement of what's happening on the run means I don't really pay any attention to outcomes, except for whether I have done the thing that I should be doing on the run, like making sure I don't overdo the effort or I don't underdo the effort, which is rarely ever the case. But so most of us, you know, tend to have this focus on or distraction, you could say, by the other stuff. And we're at least thinking about it, even if we're trying to convince ourselves it's not influencing our decisions, when I would argue it's always influencing our decisions because you can't not be influenced by things in your head. But anyway, so here's the results of, but not results, but here's the current thinking. It is actually also quite inconvenient for me because I don't know how long I'm running. And that, of course, is not exactly ideal because you don't want to like run way too long or way too short. And otherwise, my only other options are I just run the same routes that I already am familiar with, which is getting kind of old. So there's at least some kind of, all right, where's there something else here in the equation that might achieve this better without so much of an inconvenience that it's becoming tiresome. So I don't have an answer for you yet. I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing, but I will update you when the experiment has concluded. When will that be? God only knows. Because I haven't decided.
All right.
So that's that. But we have a lot more to talk to you about, and it's all very interesting. So let's get started with your questions.
First question up is from Kathy. She asks, is it possible that someone could actually run faster on a hilly course than a flat course? I was surprised that my Chicago time was actually slower than my Boston time, and I felt I was in a similar kind of shape. So, first of all, Kathy, congrats on a great Boston race.
Right.
That's awesome. And there are a lot of variables going on. So who knows exactly all that played into your day, your sleep, getting to the start line, all of those factors that can influence your race.
Maybe you race better a little bit later in the morning.
Okay.
As opposed to super early. Chicago's a really early race. Boston's obviously a late one.
So there's a lot of things going on, but in general, the physics do say that a hilly course, you do have to exert more power, more energy, and yes, they usually are slower than flat courses.
Yeah, and that's where that's obviously a simple generalization that's going to apply at a general level. If you just look at aggregate data, they will show you that people run faster on flat courses than hilly courses. People run faster in Chicago than Boston, period. And yet, so we say that, well, Ryan Hall ran the fastest ever marathon by an American man on the Boston course. And no one's run faster still since then. That was quite a long time ago, pre-super shoes even. But they said that that day in particular was like the most perfect weather you could possibly have. And they had a tailwind, since it's a point-to-point race, the entire time, which obviously counts for something. So tailwind trumps hills in that particular instance. So this is where we get into the point of like, there's a lot of other factors involved here.
And Boston, let's remember that it is a very difficult course, but it also is net downhill. Am I right?
I don't know, but it has more downhill than people give it credit for. And the hills are not as bad as people talk about, just compared to hilly running in general, but because of where they are in the race, people tend to really have a hard time with them because they're in the worst moment of the race, basically.
But there are some benefits of hills. So some people might do better on at least a gradual rolling hill in their marathon. And that's because the hill requires recruitment from your calves, glutes, hamstrings, and quads. And that can really help people who are running in maybe a quad dominant way. Let's say that someone ends up running quad dominant. They're not really using their glutes and hamstrings. Well, then the hill fires them up and then they are using it. It wakes them up and then they're recruiting again. So it can really help people get back into, like I said, wake them up, recruiting their good form and that neuromuscular activity. And runners who are strong and they run on hills regularly are not going to be as affected. So when they do have a good day, they're more likely to be able to see a better result than someone who's underprepared for the hills too. So there is a dynamic difference between the preparedness of a person going on a flat course versus a hilly course. So it all depends on how that person's training and their strengths in running.
A number of our own athletes have run personal best marathons on Boston's course as well. And have run other ones like Chicago and others. So it's an impossible thing to say this course is better than this course for me, period, unless you have enough data. So in that instance, you have to run both of them many times before you now have enough data to suggest there's a clear one's better than the other. Because as Andy said, the day matters, the other considerations matter. And it is true that our bodies respond better to dynamic terrain than static terrain, at least to a degree. But it also is true that dynamic terrain costs more energy in total. So which is the greater cost then? The total energy cost or the muscle recruitment factor of a flat course, which is leveraging the same muscles in the same way, at least in a higher sense? It's a difficult question to answer, except for across broad generalizations.
So if you do have a hilly course, a couple of things to remember, and we've talked about on the show, is that you don't want to power up the hills, which you've heard people mention that that might be something that you want to do, well, don't do that. Don't power up the hills, especially in a marathon. You have to think about the costs to you. So
let the hill slow you down is what Andy said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Give it the proper effort. Now, you might feel a little like it is a little bit more effort, but in general, don't do anything crazy or dynamic. Try to keep an even effort if you can. And a quick cadence rather than pushing off really hard. Make sure you keep your torso upright, because when we're tired, we tend to collapse, and that is going to be really difficult on your body. For running any amount of time, but like on hills, it's especially going to slow you down if you are hunching over. So those are a couple of considerations. And then downhill, not overstriding, where you're landing really hard in front of yourself and pretty much like shoving your femur into your hip.
Okay.
You don't want to do that because...
Graphic.
Well, that's kind of what people end up doing if they overstride on a hill. So you want to, again, be light down the hill as well.
Yep. Good.
So all that to say, give yourself your best shot on the day. Don't count out... a course for a really good day for you. And again, we don't recommend focusing on a pace anyway. So whatever that day yields, open yourself up to the opportunities of that, and then look for the positives of that course and run it accordingly. So you know there's going to be hills. Well, you're going to want to strategize for that, and you're going to want to incorporate hills into your training.
There you go. You've got Andy's wisdom. So your problems are solved. And in this case, it wasn't actually a problem we're solving. But thank you for asking, Kathy, and always appreciate questions like that. Speaking of, we've got one more here from Chelsea now. And this one in particular is related to precise suggestions in her training currently. So I'll give you the question. Chelsea wrote, I was a little surprised to see my long run at 120 minutes. It seems like I'm running a lot for focusing on a buildup for a spring half marathon. So here we are in December. She's running a half marathon in the spring, and her long run recommendation is 2 hours. I was just wondering, she continues, the thought process behind the volume of what I'm running. That is a great question.
Mm-hmm.
Both specifically for you, Chelsea, in your situation, and for all of us as we consider why are certain things happening at certain times. Take it away, Andy.
Well, we talk about the ingredients that you need to run a strong distance race. And you need that musculoskeletal resilience. That's the strength of your bones, your tendons, your ligaments, as you're running in that running motion. So you want to have long runs. They're the bread and butter. And it also gives you great low-end aerobic training that is not going to cost you too much going forward in your plan too. So they're going to be a lower effort, lower cost, then you can continue on in your training either the next day or 2 days later if you have a rest day after, and you're going to be able to train healthily with that. So we recommend that the long run is the priority run within the week because it gives you so much benefit.
Especially during that period of time where you're just building up your total volume still. So this is where the question gets a little bit strange to people, Chelsea, is because if someone were saying to us, well, I want to train for a mile race in 4 months, we would have that same person. We recommend running 2 to 2.5 hour long runs. And someone will say, why does someone running a 1 mile race need to run 2 to 2.5 hour long runs? That's the answer. Andy's answer is in combination, one, that strength, the structural strength, musculoskeletal, is an imperative for sustaining healthy training of any type. So you need that to do any kind of good quality training at a healthy level. There's lots of ways to grow that. This happens to be, as Andy was articulating, one of the more effective and efficient ways. It is low cost once you build up the resilience to it, and it is very high value. Now, there is another side of this, and this is an interesting. So I got into a recent debate. Well, it's not a debate. In an exchange of thoughts with my pal Jed. Shout out to Jed. If there is a co-mastermind to the weird thoughts in Zach's head about running, Jed is the co-mastermind. He's always suggesting things that change the strangeness of what I'm thinking. Now, that being the case, so Jed says to me, he says, well, I'm very, very interested in examining the concept of this training effect that so many, like the Koros and the Garmins and stuff, produce this stat that they call a training effect, and they're measuring the benefit of your exercise and the impact it has on your aerobic, essentially, on your training potential. So, and we're talking about this, and he says, okay, so we know things like long runs have a pretty high training effect. They're very positive. But if you contrast something like a very easy long run of 2 to 2.5 hours with a moderate to strong effort 1 hour run, the watches say the training effect is substantially higher for the 1 hour run. And in fact, they would be true in most instances, not always, but they would be true. Now, this is specifically Jed examining his own data. So I can't promise that that same information would be produced for everyone else. But as it were, the reason why that is because we're looking at things like heart rate information and some of those other considerations and saying sustaining a higher heart rate for a shorter period of time, if it's a certain degree higher, is more valuable to your aerobic system than a much lower heart rate for a longer period of time. And if aerobic system were the only thing we were trying to grow, then that would be a worthwhile exchange every time. And we should probably just skip the long run and just do lots of 1 hour high aerobic efforts, right? Not just that, but other things similar. So of course, that's not the only thing. And this is why, because doing that run and achieving its full benefit requires a strong structural system, musculoskeletal. But it's not as valuable without the strong musculoskeletal system, and it's much higher risk. So I'm gonna get hurt if I'm doing hard effort stuff when my body is not strong enough to handle it. And so then the question becomes, well, can't you build strength that way too? And the answer is yes, but it's higher risk and it's not as efficient. You can't do things like that very often, especially when you have not yet built up the system. And here's the example. If you're at the early stages of your training, you try to run 3 hard efforts a week. Don't go out and just try and test my theory here, because someone else has already tested it. Lots of other people. So trust the other people who have tested this theory. Start your training cycle early days, like the first couple weeks after you've taken some time off or low key running, you're not built up yet, and run 3 hard efforts a week with something as well that's a little bit longer, so you have a long run. Do that, and it will not go super well for you. But in that same week, if you run just a bunch of easy running and increase the volume a little bit, you can handle that much better. And the next week, you're going to feel a lot better doing that again. Now, fast forward. 6, 7, 8 weeks later, now try running 3 hard efforts in a week with a long run after you have sustained a decent running load at very easy efforts for a long time. And not only will you feel a lot better and you will do it more healthily, but it's going to have a better training effect for you. It's your heart rate's going to be lower overall on even the harder effort stuff. Like, it's good for you. So the answer to the question then, Chelsea, becomes, if I want to do X as a distance runner, then Y is the best path to that. And Y is a combination of a few things. And one of them is long, easy running, especially in the early stages. And if you're doing long races throughout, you should be doing the long, easy running throughout your whole training cycle. If you're doing shorter races, it becomes less valuable in the late stages, which would be what your training would look like. And if you were training for a mile, it would look different in the last few weeks. So there you go. Have we thoroughly addressed?
I thought it was a fantastic question. And one that a lot of runners do ask or want to ask and haven't yet. So that's why we're grateful to answer questions on air, because many of you were probably wondering the same thing.
There you go. So that was really helpful stuff. And now we're going to move on to some more helpful stuff. We have had a couple different guests in the last 2 weeks share thoughts about training by effort. You heard Steph and Pete, and they both had a lot of key observations about what this looks like. But this week, we wanted to further emphasize how developing this training approach is both a process and a highly individual one at that, full of nuance. So to do that, we've got 3 guests for you. First, let's introduce today's lineup.
Allie is up first. Here we want you to hear from someone who is both new to our work and approach, as well as, more importantly, new to the sport as a whole.
I trained for a half marathon in 2022, and then I kind of took a little bit of a break. I ran another half marathon this July, and I did a couple other small races in between there. And I just had this nagging thought that, you know what, I want to try the marathon. And that is kind of a scary thought for me just because I haven't been running that long. And a marathon is much bigger than a half marathon. I think that the mileage is daunting a little bit. And my biggest thing was I just don't want to get injured and I want to do it the right way. And even if it takes a while, and even if, you know, I do it a little bit slower, I just want to do it right. I was just like, you know what? I need someone to lay out the plan for me, give me a way to do this without injuring myself. And I just needed someone to confide in throughout this journey because being a newer runner, I don't have all that knowledge that I need to know that I need to have right now. So I definitely just needed some guidance and I needed someone to walk me through, like, hey, this is how you do it right. This is how you do it, you know, gradually. I tend to go all out. When I first started running, I didn't know you were supposed to do easy runs. I was just going all out in every single run, found a plan online, and although it worked okay, I needed some real guidance.
Appreciate your candor, Allie, and thank you for sharing your prior misconceptions as well as need to learn more about the sport and learn it better. Those are important factors for, you know, we all have challenges and misconceptions and general understandings that we need to develop. And so your willingness to share those thoughts and also to continue that conversation here in a moment. We appreciate that.
Next, let's pivot to someone who has not only been running for decades, but has seen substantial success recently. Here's Laura.
So I'm, like you said, I'm not new to running. My first marathon was in 2000. That is 2000, Chicago Marathon. And so that was, you know, 23 years ago. I was 25 then. Decided that it looked like a fun thing to do. I had run, you know, leisurely some 5Ks for a couple of years and saw some friends that were talking about Chicago Marathon. And the year before I had went with them to watch, and then thought maybe I could do it. But I looked at the, like, a calendar that was online on like what your miles are should be in the training. I'm like, oh, I psyched myself out of it. So it's very psychological running. But then I thought, well, okay, the Riverbank 25K, I do that next year. And then if that goes well, it's only 11 more miles to do a marathon. You know, okay, let's do it. So that, you know, I signed up, you know, that's a time when you could sign up 6 weeks or a month before the marathon, and it was super cheap. I had the Hal Higdon marathon training plan that you could get online, and you got his daily emails. That was really old school. I think he was my first, like, marathon guru that I would like read about or follow his advice. So then that was fairly successful, you know, based on my little running, I guess. I completed that in 3 hours and 37 minutes. So for me, it was easy to qualify for Boston because at that time the qualifying time was 3:40. So I went on to do, since then, from now until then, like three Bostons, 15, 16 marathons. There's about three kids in the mix there, one major injury. But I never really had a running coach and something I super followed. But it just kind of run based on however I felt and what in my mind, what that long run should be like on the weekend. And maybe there would be a little bit of speed work or so. But I moved out and away from my kind of core running group about 15 years ago. So since then, it's typically been just solo running, except for like running races. And then I would see like my running friends and such. So I've never run by effort. I was always thinking about, okay, how many miles? What pace should I be? Really, what's an easy pace? who knows, you're not running super hard, right? You must, it's not racing. So kind of feel comfortable. And then, you know, what's a fartlek or a tempo run? What's a threshold run? There's so much noise out there. But I thought, gosh, what if I can really stay accountable and put in some work? Let's see how I can, how my training can improve. So that's kind of when I reached out to A to Z Running, after having listened to many podcasts, and knowing a friend that had been successful in that type of training. So yeah, it really it paid off. This past Indianapolis Marathon, I PR'd by 4 minutes. From a PR that was 15 years old. So.
And finally, let's bring on Craig both to share some of his background and to lead us into the topic further by talking about what has led to his recent successes. So Craig, let's start with, you have, as you just said, you have seen evidence of successes within the approach in terms of training by effort, trying to become intuitive with your running and training approach. Where have you seen some of those successes, or what points in your mind to the potential that it works?
Yeah, actually, I started the journey about 7 years ago and got bit by the bug is that, hey, I really would like to BQ. And so I've been trying to BQ now, and I've now done 39 different marathons, of which 26 have been legitimate BQ attempts. And I was following, hey, you got to work this hard, you got to hit this pace. I was doing the Yasso 800s and, you know, doing everything to get to the exact second and everything. And, you know, I would end up cramping up or I'd get injured. And just after several years, my times were, you know, I'd be going real well at the beginning of the marathon, and then something would happen and I'd be more than an hour beyond my BQ time. So I knew something had to happen, do something different. And thus, when I found you guys, you know, I've had some reasonably good success in the fact that I have, you know, I don't want to be upfront. I have not BQ'd yet, but on the other hand, I've been able to accomplish some other goals. This year I did run 12 marathons in 11 months, and several of those were legitimate all-out attempts. I did get to 24.8 miles on the last BQ attempt before I cramped up, and I was on target to BQ until that time. Even though I haven't made my time yet, I do believe that this has allowed me to get the amount of the aerobic activity in by going at the level of effort. I've actually, you know, I think I've stayed healthier. I have not been injured. I'm not beat up after a marathon. I recover a whole lot quicker.
That's someone who's been doing this thing for a while. Remember, 39 marathons.
Congrats, Craig.
That's awesome. But what does this look like for someone who's just trying to figure this thing out? Let's bring it back to Allie.
We started talking about, well, one of the things we do with runners is we try to train based on what is needed, you know, the effort that you need to do based on how you're feeling and some of those kinds of things. As we've talked about that, and as we've begun only recently starting to integrate these thoughts with you, at this point in time, what stands out to you about that? Does it make sense to you? Are there areas where you're like, I don't know exactly where we're going yet, but here's where what I'm thinking or what I have noticed? What stands out to you?
Honestly, I really liked the effort-based program. I was addicted to my watch, and I'm still trying to get away from that a little bit, but the effort honestly just gives me a lot of, like, I just feel like I'm enjoying running a little bit more. I'm not so addicted to the times, and life happens. I have kids and I've gotten sick, and honestly, my paces aren't always going to represent my effort because they're going to be a little bit different. To where beforehand I would have this pace in mind and thinking, okay, I have a tempo run, I have to run this pace or it's not a tempo run, but really I'm giving more effort because, you know, I don't feel great that day. And the time on feet and the effort base has just been really nice because I think it just allows me to, you know, be a human. I have stuff happening. You know, I don't get a lot of sleep one night. My kids are up sick and my effort will be the same, but my paces are going to be different. And I think that it's really nice not to be so set on that and be so set on, you know, this is the pace I have to hit for this run or this run. And my easier runs have been really humbling. And I'm still working on slowing down a little bit on the easier runs because I struggle with that a little bit. But my easy paces that I thought were easy were actually not. So I think it's been really nice. I think at the beginning, I had a few questions obviously about it, like everyone does. And right now I'm in like this building phase or recovery, then building phase. So a lot of my runs are easy. And I know I asked Andy, I was like, am I going to lose fitness doing this? Am I going to lose all my progress because I'm not running fast? But I've, you know, watched some of your other podcasts and stuff, and I understand the reasoning behind it. But yeah, the biggest thing honestly has just been, it's been really nice not to be so addicted to the data and to my watch and just allowing kind of my body to do what it needs to do rather than pushing it in a certain direction just because I need to hit a certain pace.
Well, these are important considerations, in part because training is not just about getting faster, but as we like to say, thriving. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your early observations there, Allie, and looking forward to more conversations with you as we progress as well.
Let's turn things back now to Laura and her thoughts about transitioning to a different type of training approach.
Yeah, running by effort is hard. It was hard for me in the beginning in the training plan. And I think it still is hard to think, okay, easy running, jogging pace, to really slow down and slow down by what does that really feel like? So I kind of would base that off of my breathing. It's harder, you know, it's harder, but also easier because you don't have that pressure on yourself to go out there and hit certain paces during your long run necessarily or your every, but running easier by effort allows you to build a better level of fitness, I feel like. I would never have been able to do, you know, a 70-mile week of training, even though that wasn't prescribed. When I look at my stats, you know, there was a couple of weeks of 70 and some high 60s, but I had never hit those numbers before. And I felt good. So, I mean, that was all because I was able to run those at effort versus running them hard.
So Laura, if there's someone thinking about changing how they run, even if they've been doing it a long time, what would you say to them?
I would just say, go for it. You know, give it a try, put some effort into it and, you know, hold yourself accountable. And it does work. It's going to be mentally hard and you're going to question like, is this pace feel right? Am I running slow enough? Because I know myself and many others out there, you want to go and run and you probably do the same route just about every day, perhaps. And you know where, you know, what your times are like, and you want to just push and you want to get done quicker, but going out there and taking it easy and running slow and running longer than maybe you're used to for whatever event you're training for, you know, it's going to pay off. It might not seem like it makes sense because you question in your head, you know, what if I'm running slow, how am I going to get faster? So that was kind of what I was thinking, but I'm like, oh, it's summer. I'm enjoying running, listening to running podcasts. it made a difference.
As Laura suggested, this is difficult and for various reasons. Let's go back to Craig to address one more common challenge that can arise for runners who do this kind of thing.
So Craig, I've got one more question at the moment. And it's another angle of just one layer that's challenging with a training method like this. And we haven't really spent a lot of time on it in the past. So I'll appreciate any of your thoughts. You have shared with us, you mentioned earlier that you view yourself as a social runner. Certainly you enjoy being with other people when you're doing this thing. And you're not alone. As you know, many runners run because, or at least started running because of others, whether it's friends or family or something. And they have found community within the running experience. Oftentimes the, you know, the early morning run group meetings or evening run group meetings, things like that. And yet our training approach specifically asks a runner to give the effort no matter what it produces on the day. So that means some days you're running slower, some days you're running faster, some days you don't know exactly what it's going to look like when you start. And it's, you know, as you're feeling certain ways over the course of the run, that's difficult when it comes to running with other people. How have you experienced that challenge? And what is it like in terms of being able to still enjoy time with other people while trying to maximize the training?
Yeah, it is a challenge. Like I said, there was the one training cycle where I did have the one running buddy adjusted their schedule to follow exactly what I was going to do. And they had great success with it. Since then, I still run. We still run together and run with others, but it is a challenge because their focus seems to be, hey, I want to do 40 or 45 miles this week. And they're going to, if their marathon BQ pace is 9 minutes, they're going to be near 9 minutes. And my easy miles are not 9 minutes. They're slower than that. So it makes it, I've had to, you know, find other runners to be able to run with, and then meet up with them at the water stations. So they're stopping every 3 miles, and usually they're taking several minutes. It's a social stop for them as well. So you know, I can catch up, and we do run a little bit, you know, as we yo-yo back and forth, but it has, you know, it has been difficult. You know, I've met some other runners.
Well, for some, that is a bigger challenge than others, this idea of social running and the desire to run with other people. Zach, for instance, doesn't much care whether he runs with other people, but Andy does.
A lot.
Yes.
So, do you want me to talk about it?
Yes.
I really love social running, and this has been a struggle for me because my effort perception changes when I run with friends. I feel that it is easier. And
that's
later,
not necessarily a good thing, Andy.
I know. That's why I'm saying I have to be able to set some guardrails. So, for instance, one thing that I do when I will run with friends, especially as I'm getting back from an injury, as I have been, it feels like forever, I have to say, hey, I am not going to run faster than X pace. We don't like to talk about paces here. We like to talk about effort, but it is a good guardrail against overdoing it so that they kind of know where I'm at and what I'm planning to do, and that can help set me up for success in a group run. Also, if there are friends that are quite a bit faster than me that I want to run with, when I get into a conditioning phase or when I start doing some of the harder running, if I want to do a steady state with a friend, I typically am doing it with a friend who is much faster than me. And so they're doing their easy run while I'm doing their my steady run, or they're doing like a more moderate thing, or they have like a more of a range that is tolerable for them in their training, whatever the case may be.
Or they're running, quote, easy in their minds when in reality they're getting the same workout in that Andy is.
But what I'm saying here is that I think it's good to have clear communication and to be able to let them go. I've done that before. I've let friends go before where I said, hey,
you're not my friend anymore.
No, I keep my friends by communicating while telling them that I have to just continue to do what I'm doing. And then, you know, we have that kind of relationship, or we've talked about it beforehand, so it doesn't feel awkward when the event occurs. So, hey, you go on, get your run in. I'll see you at the end, or thanks for the run. I'll catch up with you in a while or something. But having it be comfortable to do so by clearly communicating beforehand that this is a possibility. So I've done that before, and I also have made mistakes before where I hung on and then kind of sabotaged myself. So the difficulty with this is that once you run too hard for what should be an easy run, then when you have your next harder effort, typically you're not fully recovered for it, and it's a cascading effect, and you can end up either not getting the quality that you should be getting because you're not ever rested enough to do it, or you're overtraining and then you end up with some burnout or just not getting the adaptations because you're not allowing your body the time to create those.
Yeah. Now, to Craig's comment, he mentioned, you know, my friend might be running substantially faster than me on an easy day. And that's a good solution for Craig, as Andy suggested in her example, because that could be potentially the right pace for Craig on a steady effort day. And so he might be able to do something like, hey, when are you going to run next? Well, I'll orient my steady run around that so I can still run with you, even though we're not necessarily doing the same type of effort. That works too.
Mm-hmm. You just want them to talk more than you if they're able to, so they can, you know. Anyway, Zach and I've tried to do that with Zach before, and he's like, I will not be contrived into this conversation.
So Laura brings up another challenge, though. We're not quite done yet, because recall her recent 15-year-old marathon PR, 4 minutes at that. Nice mm-hmm. work, Laura. Very impressive. Well, one of her challenges, as she shares, is knowing what you can do and how to execute it.
I still will run during the marathon or during the training and have my AirPods in, and I could hear like the mile splits and pace and distance and whatever. But, you know, really doing the training by the effort, I think, helps me go longer and get more of a good solid base. And just not being worried about every run being a certain distance and a certain and pace. Just doing, you know, every day feels easy, might feel different one day than it does on another day. But I, you know, I was thinking about pace during the marathon, but also kind of doing it on effort, what I thought I could run. But I was actually kind of worried going into the marathon thinking, okay, gosh, I've been doing a lot of easy running. Though the last handful of weeks before the marathon, there was the conditioning and some 1 or 2 mile time trial type running. But I really wasn't sure, like, what can I do? What can I expect? Because I'm the one that's maybe a type A that wants to know, okay, this is my goal. This is what I want to hit. This is what I should be doing. So I was like a little nervous thinking, okay, well, what's possible? What can my body do? So yeah, I was pleasantly surprised, but still I've got more goals and I still have, you know, times I want to break that 3:16 and, you know, a 3:15, a 3:10. So I'm not done yet.
So there you have it. The approach emphasizes development and is very much a process. Here in just these three different examples, three different runners with three very different experiences, perspectives, nuances, and even in the kind of state of successful implementation, it does not look the same for each of them, at least not at this time. It may look more familiar over time, but they're in the process. They're on a journey. So that's to be expected. We would say that for all runners. These things don't look exactly the same for each one of us all the time. And we should be okay with that, but we should all be aspiring toward developing our running intuition. And insofar as we are doing that, over time, it will tend to look more like a certain kind of thing, as we've tried to showcase some of those examples. We got more coming at you soon, but that's probably good for now.
Let's get on to the world of running.
Quick shout out to CJ, A to Z runner, who won the Dallas Marathon Friday Night Lights 1 mile elite section. And I got to see the finishing clip And it was a blazing fast kick. So nice work, CJ.
The Merritts ran the Whoville 5K with their family.
There's no clear way to prove that you've done that, though.
I saw a photo.
Ah, okay. What's the evidence? Because it's not
also,
a
there's
race.
Probably other people who did run that yeah. and jumped into other fun, festive races. Chrissy ran the Santa Hustle Half last
what?
Week. Yes. And she ran, I'd say she gets double props because
She ran double people.
Yes. She's pregnant and she ran the half. So it's almost like she ran a full, right? Does that count that way? Is that math,
not,
mathing?
No, she just okay. counts as two people running it. We'll give her that.
Congratulations,
okay.
Chrissy.
Great. That's fun. Well done. All right. Speaking of fun things, the second of the high school national cross country races, and finally, the last high school cross country race of the year. Wow, it is so late for cross country.
So long. They start in August training yeah. for cross country.
Yeah, I mean, they're racing in August, some of them. Hopefully not some of these kids. They usually start racing a little later than most high schoolers because they anticipate a longer season. But anyway, Foot Locker, the classic. The historical Foot Locker at Balboa Park in San Diego. Is that where that is? Yeah. So this one's always fun. There's a huge debate out there in the world right now of running nerds like us about which is the true national championship now for high school. Is it Nike Cross or is it Foot Locker? It certainly was Foot Locker historically, but Nike Cross has been gaining in its level of competitiveness. And I would say that on the whole, they're still fairly kind of the same thing. There's not much difference. Most of the runners who are top tier runners run one or the other or both. But when you get one or the other, you get like some of them doing Nike and some of them doing Foot Locker.
Yeah, it's not like all go to
I
one.
Mean, yeah. Mm-hmm. So then what they're going to say, people are going to say things like, well, the people who are top 10 in Foot Locker wouldn't have even been like top 20 at Nike compared to how they raced against those other people and like state championship stuff and everything. And it's like, yeah, but they're two different races.
They're just two different races.
And who knows, because they didn't race each other in that instance. Because when they do race each other, you tend to see some pretty comparable results. You know, if Addie Ritzenhine ran both races, would she have won both of them? I don't know. I think she had a good shot at it, but that doesn't mean she would have, for sure. All right, enough of that. Let's talk about what happened.
Yeah. Elizabeth Lechman. Got her redemption.
Yeah.
She went out really hard at Nike Nationals last week, and she ended up fading to 15th.
It was brutal.
She dominated the field for 4K.
Yeah, but it was nasty, sloppy day.
It was nasty, sloppy.
Mud and stuff, which just drains you, and the more tired you are, the more cost it is.
Yeah.
And that definitely hurt her.
It hurt. It looked like it hurt. But this time, she seemed to gauge herself better for the course and ended up winning the race. So that's why I called it the race of redemption for her. Rachel Forsyth, she also went hard again because she had the early lead before Lechman took it.
Forsyth took the race out.
Right. Like the very beginning.
At
very
Nike Nationals.
Yep. And this time, she also went hard with the lead. Yep.
She did the exact same
But for longer.
It worked better is the way you'd answer here. It worked better this time. I still don't know that it's an advisable race strategy for high-level racing. Before you give it away.
Okay.
Someone did have an astute observation. I don't remember who this person was. Probably like on the message boards or something. So Rachel Forsyth and most of these girls in these races – generally the whole season and like all of their life running in the last recent past have no competition on a regular basis. Like they win races by minutes much of the time. And so Rachel Forsyth is very comfortable and the norm for her is just being way out ahead of everyone. And so there's a good chance that it is a very uncomfortable thing for her to like race in a pack of people. And as such, she feels that her best chances may be just putting herself out there and then with that separation, hoping that she can stay one step ahead.
Okay.
That's reasonable.
Yeah. I have to say, she held better.
Better, yes.
And I think it was a valiant finish because she looked like she was in a world of hurt. I don't know if she was. She looked like she's in a world of hurt, and it was a strong finish for her. She ended up in third.
That's not bad.
Yeah. So she led through halfway, and Lechman caught her around mile two.
Yeah. And didn't actually, like, so initially when she caught Forsyth, Lechman was not able to create separation right away. Forsyth actually tried to put on another surge, which is pretty bold. And if you're going to do a surge, that's a great time to do it, right? When someone thinks that they can kind of chill for a bit when they catch you. But it didn't break Lechman, and then she eventually was able to pull away not long after, a couple minutes later.
But she held tough.
Yep.
And let me tell you, cross country is so tough, because once you have gone too far over the line, it is so hard in cross country to keep your mind in it.
Yeah.
And to stay competitive, which Forsyth did do. Allie Zeeland was second place, and she was 14 seconds behind the pair at 2 miles, and she caught Forsyth for second place.
Yeah, so very, she did
the hunting game. Yep. The hunting game is, in my opinion, the more fun game.
Ask Addie Rittenhain how she feels about that.
Yeah, the hunting game is fun. Lechman continued the trend of super fast sophomores, because you'll remember Addie Rittenhain from last week at Nike Nationals is also a sophomore.
It is kind of a weird thing to think that all of the national championships this year for the girls were won by underclassmen.
That's
kind of weird.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's only the second fastest, not only, but that is the second fastest a sophomore has ever run at Foot Locker.
Okay.
At all. And the fastest was Julie something, Stable, from 1994.
Wow.
So underclassmen don't usually perform at that high of a level at this point in the season, but there she was.
All right, on to the boys' race, Zach.
Top three finishers were all from the same Foot Locker region. So the Northeast area was representing very well. And the top two, first and second place, in fact, were both from Pennsylvania, which is especially interesting because no Pennsylvanian has ever won Foot Locker before. And now they took first and second in the same race. So that's kind of, you know,
historic representing. For Pennsylvania.
The state is representing well, and happens to be the Pittsburgh area, for anyone who's curious. Drew Griffith won the race with his state compatriot Ryan Pajak in second. And both boys are signed to run collegiately at Notre Dame.
Oh, it's fun that they're going to go together. Right? That's cool. I like that.
In fact, we don't know the state of their camaraderie, but the two of them actually have raced close to each other a number of times, but they're in different divisions in high school. So they're both state champions this year, one in the Division II, one in the Division III. And then when they get on to like the national level stuff, they're pretty tight. They went 1-2 here at Foot Locker Nationals. Well, in their regional meet, they also went 1-2, only in the opposite order. So it's kind of a fun little, hopefully it's a fun competitive rivalry and will turn into a great teammateness.
It could be a really beneficial thing.
Yeah,
it could be fun.
Tamrat Gavinus was then in third place, also from the same region. So good representation.
Next up, this is a very different race, one that we don't see terribly often, a road mile in Paradise called the Mary Mile in Hawaii.
Now, do they actually call it a mile in Paradise? Is that like the name of the event? Because that actually wouldn't be a bad idea.
A mile? I know. I that's my idea. So maybe I should like make that happen.
Like,
do you want to do that?
Paradise races, like, in Paradise?
No, I don't want to do that. Mile race in Paradise?
Because it would be incredibly difficult to organize a race on the other side of the world.
I was teasing, obviously. but the Mary Mile, I like the name of the Mary Mile as well. So those are both good. Let's get on to the race. Well, as many of you, if you've been following along in the world of running, know, there was a newly minted world record in the road mile set by USA's very own Hobbs Kessler.
Because you're starting to wonder, oh, Hobbs Kessler, that's really impressive. Well, it's not the fastest time anyone's ever run in a road mile, but the record had never been officially kept by World Athletics. So you could say it technically isn't the fastest. It's not like the world record, but there has to be some kind of organizing body that keeps the records. This is just how these things go, you know, like the Guinness Book of World Records, for instance, and all that kind of stuff. Well, apparently, I don't know why, World Athletics didn't have a record for a one-mile race on the roads. Now they do, as of September of 2023.
Mm-hmm.
And the first to set it was Hobbs Kessler. Mm-hmm. But there will be others attempting it, like in this race.
Yeah. Yared Nuguse of the OAC, our American record holder, took a stab at it. You'll remember Nuguse's time is 3:43.97. That's his American record from outdoors.
That's only a shade slower than the world record.
Yes. Yes.
For a point of reference.
Mm-hmm. Like, was threatening the likes of Jakob Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. he tailed him all the way to the line.
Yep.
Crazy.
So, when someone like Yared Nuguse is going to run a road mile and there is a world record like that, that he's run significantly under, everybody has their eyes on it. However, this time, Nuguse did not take the world record, although he did take the win in a time of 3:56.58, which was just shy of the world record. That is 3:56.13, so half a second.
Yep, that's close. Bummer. Sorry, Nuguse. You had a chance at it. You'll have to do it again sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Vincent Ciatti was in second, and that's a name you should recognize anytime you see road miles out there, because this dude runs them all and finishes in the top three pretty much every time. So Ciatti, in 3:56, was runner-up, by the way, collegiately in the NCAA outdoor 1500 and indoor mile with Virginia Tech back in 2018.
Mm-hmm. And third was Hobbs Kissler.
Your
who
current.
Is the current world record holder, and he ran 3:57. So it was a really close race on the men's side. Exciting to see, although there were big bonuses for that world record. $10,000 is what the race was going to pay
Goose.
Out. So, but
four tenths of a second for 10 G's.
When he was asked, he said he was happy. He raised some great guys. He got to do it in Hawaii. I mean, his team was there. There's a bunch of guys from his team.
Yared Nuguse has a sunny disposition.
He does, and I appreciate that.
It is quite to be appreciated.
Yeah.
I do not. But as it were, I do appreciate. I just don't
how
have
much,
a similar disposition.
How much does a man and his turtle really need? You know, like he probably doesn't feel like he needs to have.
I was hoping you wouldn't say that. Andy was prepping that line for days.
No, I was not. But I did say it once before, I will admit.
She's been saying it nonstop.
On the women's side, Nikki Hiltz took away the win in a 4:28. And this was one of those races where they create a race between the men's and the women's field. And the women are given a 30-second head start. The field
That's
is.
That's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And Hiltz was fifth overall. And
between
this
so after the first four men, then Hiltz.
Yep.
Oh, so almost caught.
Nozomi Tanaka. This is the exciting stat for the women's field. Ran a 4:29, which is a new national record for Japan.
A road record.
Road record.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then third was USA's Wayne Colati in 4:30. So that's exciting
also
for
a tight
her too.
Race.
Mm-hmm. Tight race.
Fun stuff. I wonder if I just keep thinking about this. Were these runners there to compete, or were they there for a vacation and can get a competition, which, you know, then help the brand underwrites your vacation, things like that, right? I wonder about that.
They're going to be getting into full swing with indoor likely pretty soon.
Yeah.
Unless this is an Olympic year. So maybe not.
Well,
maybe
some
of these runners might not be gearing for an indoor season because they are going to be looking at outdoor for the Olympic trials.
Yes. Now, there is a world championships this year in cross country, which is coming up fairly soon. It's in the winter. I don't think so in indoor track, though, right? They wouldn't.
It would be very crazy if they had. I think that'd be bizarre.
Either way, it's not a focal point for the high-level professional runners right now because it's an Olympic year.
Now, Zach has a hodgepodge of interesting things to share with you.
Nice word. All right, so I teased it on the opener, but we need you to take a guess before we disclose it. And if you already know, then you already know. But an NCAA collegiate runner finishing the cross-country season signed a professional contract. We will give you two guesses. You have to get it right in those two guesses because there's no chance it's anyone but one of these two. Okay? It's either Parker Valby or Caitlin Tuohy. It has to be, right? Caitlin Tuohy is an obvious pick. We'll get into that. Parker Valby, though, is on a super hot streak right now. And as many have learned, that's the best time to sign a pro contract because you're going to get your best offers. Having just broken, you know, that crazy collegiate record in the indoor 5K, won the championships outdoor or in cross country, won the championships outdoor track last season. So now some will say, well, you wouldn't sign a pro contract if you're partway through a season. It's been done before. It wouldn't be the first time. You take advantage of the offers when they're coming across. However, as you probably can guess, NCAA collegiate runners, especially ones with various other contractual things going on, probably also have a contract with their university where they have to finish out a certain school year or certain scholarships have to be returned or things like that. So there's no way it's Parker Valby. I was just joking the whole time. It has to be.
Nice mislead.
Yeah, I know. It has to be Caitlin Tui.
Caitlin Tui.
She signed. It was inevitable.
You called it. You said it.
Everyone did. Everyone knew she was going to do that because she, while she's technically got eligibility still for track, I think. Actually, she might not for both. But anyway, she was going to sign. So Caitlin Tui signed professionally with Adidas.
Adidas.
No surprise there because they were also the ones working her NIL deal as well.
Okay.
So the thought now, though, is she is going to stay put, though, while she's training. Stay in the NC State area to train with the team and under her coach. Going to continue.
I think her
forward.
Coach is awesome.
Well, clearly it's been helpful.
It's been
and
good.
Successful.
Yeah, she's been successful. And there's not a lot of time between now and the Olympic trials. If she were to like jump into a new program,
not
join a new pro team, yeah. it would be difficult for her to get the best out of herself. Too much change in a single year.
So Caitlin Tui is focused on the Olympics. That's what this is all about. That's what this timing is about. And she's going to do everything she can to see if she can get a spot on the team. It's an uphill battle, as you know, if you pay close attention to these things. The top tier collegiate runners still are not on the same level as the professional females.
Yeah, give us the Alicia Munson comparison with Parker Valby's time that she just ran.
Yeah, so Parker Valby just broke the collegiate record in the indoor 5,000, 14:56, fastest by about 5 seconds of anyone ever. And Alicia Munson's U.S. 5,000 meter record is 14:19.
It's a huge
difference. Not even the same ballpark.
Right.
So now that's outdoors versus indoors. There's a lot to be said about that. But the point is, it's not, Caitlin Tui is not like an inevitable choice for a Team USA
pick.
Right. But she's going to give it a shot.
And also, Alicia Munson's like another level.
Yeah, that's true too. That record is way faster
she's
than
amazing.
Anyone else has run. Okay, so next up, we got a strange back and forth with the USATF Olympic Trials Marathon race. And we just wanted to kind of give you the heads up on what exactly happened with that and where it currently stands. So what it was there was speculation that based on a strange situation that USATF might not actually honor the finish ordering of the men's Olympic Trials Marathon race, meaning if you were top three in that race, it doesn't necessarily mean that they would actually pick you for the Olympic team, which would be a first ever. They've always just chosen the top three finishers. Well, Runner's World was reporting something about that. Let's Run had a feature on it. Turns out USATF confirmed they will honor the top three as long as those three have all run the kind of like it's kind of a B standard Olympic time of 2:11:30. So the time you need to qualify for the Olympics is 2:08 flat, and only two American men have run it. Just because a third hasn't run it, or if a third isn't in the world rankings high enough, someone's going to be there. It's almost impossible for like Scott Faubel, for instance, to get bumped out of the top 80 spots in the world rankings. And so the assumption is it's going to be there, which means USA will be able to send three athletes. It doesn't have to be the same three as the ones who are qualified. So they said, yes, we're just going to honor the finishing results. Now, in theory, it could be something like someone like me, unlikely, but someone like me could finish in the top three and run a slow time because it was like a slow tactical race, in which case I wouldn't go because I would still have to have run 2:11:30 or faster. But I'm not going to do that. And it's unlikely anyone else will who hasn't already run those times. So we'll see. It's going to be an interesting race either way. But now you know, assume it's the top three finishers for the men's and the women's for sure, but for the men's race as well, will be your Team USA on February 3rd. Is that the date of the race? I think that's the date.
February 3rd. I'm keeping track. I booked a baby.
How about the 1,500-meter world champ Josh Kerr? He is throwing some darts.
Shade.
He is doing it. So in an interview on a podcast, Josh Kerr was recently talking about, he's the one who just won the world championship 1500 this year, and talking about Jakob Ingebrigtsen. And he had a lot to say about Ingebrigtsen's weakness or apparent weakness in his eyes. Namely, Ingebrigtsen's very fast. There's no doubt about it. I mean, he's got a world record or two. He's nearly broken world records in a few different events. And always has the fastest times in the world each year, it seems, in everything he does. Well, to Kerr's credit, he said, yeah, but at the same time, those are all like time trial type paced races. He said, when you put him in a legit race with no pacers, he doesn't win nearly as much. In fact, he loses more often than he wins if history is to prove itself out, because those races are all the championships races, and he has not won a world championship 1500. Let me say that again. He has not won. He's won an Olympic gold, but that's a little bit surprising. Like, the guy who's doing it all. And so as Whiteman beat him and as Josh Kerr beat him, they both have a lot to say about whether he can race in those types of races. We'll see. He continues to prove that he is by far one of the best of all time and yet is not infallible.
Hmm. He's a person too.
Last up, Russia and Belarus have been banned from the Olympics.
I didn't know that.
Yes, that's been the case for a while now.
Okay.
Because of the Ukraine war. So Russia specifically has been banned for like forever now because they have drug cheating problems with their athletics organization. The governing body does not enforce the world doping rules appropriately. And so as a country, they have not been able to actually have a team represent Russia for quite a long time at the world level, world athletics. Well, this year's no surprise there. That was probably never going to be the case. But then at one point, they announced that they were actually just going to ban all individual Russian and Belarusian athletes because they are – so Belarus is supporting Russia in the war with Ukraine. And so because of that, because this is an international global conflict and they are the aggressors, the World Athletics Organization and the Olympic Committee said, we're just going to say you can't send athletes because this is a terrible thing you're doing. And then the question started to arise, yes, but now you're suggesting that every individual Russian and Belarusian are to be blamed for this war. And of course, that's absurd because not every individual has anything to do. Like, many of these athletes don't even live in Russia or Belarus and haven't, like, for many, many years, if not their whole lives. And so they probably shouldn't be held accountable for the decisions of their country. And so we get to the present moment, and SEBCO has announced, this was not news, but has confirmed that they will allow Russian and Belarusian athletes individually to compete neutral. They cannot represent their countries, but they will be able to compete with no national insignia on in the Olympics if they have not publicly or actively supported the war, which is itself a little bit tricky to enforce. Because they don't clearly define what it actually means to publicly support the war. That's a dangerous ground to walk because they're going to find themselves in situations where they're not sure exactly how best to enforce that with certain situations individually. But that's the line they drew, and it makes sense. And it at least allows for some individual athletes to compete still, which is just – there's such a strange, messy situation with Russia and the world athletics. One day we hope it will resolve.
Yeah.
But that's that for now. And that's all we have to say about the world of running today. As you know, there's a lot more to talk about, but we think that's probably adequate for this week.
Thank you all so much for joining us. And to our amazing guests who were able to share their insight today, thank you. And we'll talk to you next week.